What's up? Good morning. Happy post Super Bowl. How'd you survive? Did you win? Did you lose? Did you get angry? Did you flip the dip table over? Did you bust out your fucking LG TV? Did you punch it into oblivion? Did you fucking are you bailing out right now? Are you trying to post bail right now? Was it that good a Super Bowl? Was it, you know, did you come out ahead or are you incarcerated? We take our football very seriously in this country. You understand? We geek it up. We get together with all of our buddies that have been, you know, mentally prepping, watching every interview, commentary, play rundown, personal history, dating history, you know, with our buddies in our cubicles, going over game plans, playbooks. Like, there's just no way. There's just no way Brandon Ayuk doesn't get 100 yards this Super Bowl. He is the X Factor, right? All that fucking proselytizing and all that shit getting up on the stump there. But because this is what we do. This is the biggest this holiday. The Super Bowl weekend is bigger than, I think it's as big as, if not bigger than, Christmas, right? The cult of the game, right? The monstrosity that is the Super Bowl. Because the game itself is really kind of in the way. It's really getting to be marginalized. It's getting to be like, oh, God, there's like that 3-hour stretch where it's like there's something else going on, right? When really, we just want to get to the halftime show. We want the Doritos commercials, the Pepsi commercials, the one with Jerry Seinfeld, the one with this guy, the one with Jack Black, the one that Tom Brady's in, the one that the Hertz commercial. You know, how clever was that? And is there going to be a deliberate wardrobe malfunction? Who's singing the national anthem? Like, are they really going to bring out what's her name? Are they going to? It's just a whole. And then you get, and then all of a sudden we got, oh shit, we got to wait for the game. We got, oh fuck, this fucking game's in the way. Like, by the way, I'm speaking to you from Sunday, before the game. And I'm in Northern California. I would like to see the Niners win. The game is exactly, I think, 2 hours from now. I don't think they're going to win. But because, you know, the Chiefs got to play the villain. But this is kind of like manifest destiny for the Chiefs because they're going into that dynasty era. Like if they win today, which I assume they will. Like I'm thinking now this is literally 1:23 p.m. Sunday. Just over 2 hours before the game, I'm predicting 42-13. That's what it's going to be. 42-13 Chiefs. But God, that's a good Niner. I mean, that is a good Niner team. It's just that if they get to the quarterback, they can beat him, you know? And it's taking place in that strange town of Las Vegas that climate controlled, so you don't have to worry about like weather or nature or ecology, right? As long as you got that fucking $24 beer, it's $24 beer night at the Super Bowl, and you get yourself some fucking wings and some garlic fries. Now you're in at about 80, you know, probably just over 80 bucks. Ahead. like Jesus Christ. But so I woke up so woke up this morning. They let me know you were gone. Or Woke up this morning, da-na-na-na. Sat up in bed, ba-na-na-na. Clicked on the TV, ba-na-na-na. And there was the Millrose games. Yeah, Sunday they had the Millrose. It was day three of the Millrose games. Yeah. Just when you thought I was going to talk football, huh? Pump your brakes there. Pump your brakes there, freaking Vince Lombardi. Pump your brakes. Because the Millrose games did not disappoint. Damn, the 60-meter hurdles, the women's 60-meter hurdles, Bahamian princess breaks the world record coming out of nowhere. And in the men's 60-meter, Christian Coleman taking the win at 6 point, I think it was 6 point, I don't know. But all I know is it was, in the finals, there was five Americans and three Jamaicans. There's only two countries that represented the finals. Isn't that weird? But otherwise, it like I say, it didn't disappoint. That was the Millrose Games was a indoor track meet. Is an indoor track meet. It's 116 years old. So back in 1908, they decided, like, I guess some of their plywood got rained on and it kind of bent and beveled. They're like, well, I guess we'll make an indoor track with this, you know, banked indoor track, which is like half the size of a regulation outdoor quarter mile track, right? So it's indoors. And 1908, like, that's insane. One of the bigger marquee events for a long time in the Millrose games, and which I believe they're in New York, was the I think they called it the Wanamaker Mile or the Millrose Mile. Anyway, it was the Open Men's Mile. And for whatever reason, it was always dominated by Irish runners. Eamon Coghlan comes to mind right away. He usually won that in pretty good, because he was the world record holder for a long time at 3:49, which is like really that's a fast time that early in the season. Because indoor is really like, it's kind of taken on its own identity, but because they're going to have the U.S. Indoor Nationals next week, I believe, in New Mexico, in Albuquerque. And then they'll have the Indoor World Championships. So it's a thing. But in essence, it's like, it's early. It's February. Jesus, it's February running, because these guys are, it's an Olympic year. I don't know if you've caught that. I don't know if you've put that in your back pocket since the last podcast or the time before. And I was ranting about it being a leap year and an Olympic year and an election year. It's just a crazy year. So all these guys are kind of, they want to peak for June, right? But they also want to, they want to do well. A lot of them want to do well in the indoors. But the indoors is really a prep, and in my opinion, in a way I've always kind of seen it. But they're, Jesus, in the Open Men's Mile, last year, Yared Nuguse, formerly of Notre Dame College, same alma mater as Joe Montana, won in 3:47.38, I think, for a new men's American record in the mile. 3:47 is fucking good. This year, he won again, and but he ran 3:47.83. He switched the milliseconds, so he was less than half a second off his own American record. And then Hobbs Kessler, out of nowhere, same birthday as mine, March 15th, only 32 years later. So he's 20. No, yeah, yeah, he's 20 years old. He ran 3:48. Like, he barely lost. It's fucking good. And Damn, that's really good. And then what's his name? Cooper Tier, way back, finished way back. I think he just moved to Colorado to get it. Him and Cole Hawker have a new coach in Colorado. I think they left. Did they leave the Bowerman track? Everybody's leaving the Bowerman track. I don't know what's going on there. I'm not in the loop. I'm not hip. I'm not in the circle of trust. It's all good though. I don't know what these guys are going through, but he ran as respectable. I think he ran 3:53. But in the men's 2 mile, Josh Kerr, the reigning 1500 world champion, he won it last year. Anyway, he beats Grant Fisher, runs 8 flat indoors. Fuck, that's good. And then Fisher ran 8:03. With Cole Hawker coming in third at 8:05. Like, fuck. Morgan McDonald, too, coming out of nowhere in fifth at 8:12. I hadn't heard from him in a while, ever since he won the NCAA cross countries for Wisconsin. He's been struggling with some injuries. But 8:12, running for Australia. Speaking of Australia, there's this kid. I've referenced a while back, Cameron Myers is this teen prodigy. He just shattered a 36-year record under 18. Anyway, he's 17 years old. He ran 3:34 in the 1500 to break this meet record here in Australia. Like, what the fuck? Like, they're going off. These guys are going off. It's an Olympic year. And this kid, but he's 17, running 3:34. Like, that's fucking insane. And then there's this kid in Utah, a high schooler, just broke 4. Everybody's doing it, right? It's the new peer pressure. It's the new high school peer pressure. Come on, man, break 4. Everybody's doing it. This kid from Utah ran 359.87 this early in the year. The first Utah high schooler to break the 4-minute mile barrier. His name is JoJo Jordan. I guess it's weird. That sounds made up. That sounds like he's on, one of those, Saturday morning, like, educational specials, right? Like, that name sounds like he should be a Teletubby or something. JoJo Jordan, is very, like, he's a fucking stud, though. He's committed to run for Wake Forest, which is interesting because that's also where Rocky Hansen just went, who broke 4 last year, which is odd. I don't know. I mean, just because he's from Utah doesn't mean he's Mormon. I'm assuming he's Mormon, but he's probably not. If he's going to Wake Forest, because I know BYU would love to have him, but he's also run a 155.800. Which 155, huh? That's fairly pedestrian for a sub-4 miler. But he's also an 8:46 2 miler. So you don't know what this guy's got up his sleeve. It looks like. And then he won the state championships in cross country last year. But shout out to these guys. I mean, these young guys, man, just fucking, like, it's gonna be this is wild. It's gonna be a wild year. Wild, man, it's wild. But moving on. So it's been a very, it's usually a busy week for me. It's been a busy week. It's still a busy week. And I was I've been. I get low key obsessive with things, and I came across this thing, steampunk. You ever heard of steampunk? Like, I'm a little late to the game on this one. Oh, excuse me. But my youngest got me this book for Christmas, The Time Machine, H.G. Wells. And it's so out of kind of left field. Like, I hadn't asked for it. I hadn't even kind of sought out anything by H.G. Wells. But I thought, well, fuck it. Okay, hey, let's go. I mean, and it was written in 1895, and which was 9 years before the Wright brothers flew their plane at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, or South Carolina, one of them Carolinas. And only 38 years after the invention of toilet paper. I just found out toilet paper was invented in 1857. So yeah, so 38 years later, H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine, which was his, it looks as though it was his first book. He also, of course, wrote like War of the Worlds, and he was kind of like this, I mean, one of the first science fiction writers. But one of the things that I noticed is he, as I'm kind of doing a little dive on kind of the whole sci-fi, yeah, like I'm not specifically a sci-fi reader, although I've read some, you know, I read like the Philip K. Dick stuff. I've read, I don't know, Kurt Vonnegut doesn't really count, but I've read a couple of his books. Seems like I've read others, but I just drawn a blank right now. But I'll indulge in this. But one thing that I had this thing, this by like some kind of divine placement in my own psyche, this word kept floating to the surface, and it was steampunk. And I'm like, that's a really cool phrase, and I don't know what it means, and I don't know anything about it. And it's, you know, I've heard people kind of banter about it, talk about it. It's kind of a cosplay thing. I've heard Elon Musk talk about how he was into it, and it seems like, oh, okay, steampunk, what is that? What is it? And what it is, the best way, I guess, to describe it would be, and you probably already know what it is, but I'm always late to the game, but it's basically this genre of retro-futuristic kind of stories and that lend themselves to, like, well, like the book The Time Machine. And supposedly H.G. Wells is kind of like the godfather of steampunk, or the father of steampunk, I don't know. But what it basically means is, like, the best two-word description that I came across was retro-futuristic, if that makes sense. Typically, and it's typically kind of like characters in a steampunk genre are usually parading around in like a top hat with goggles, and the goggles are on the top hat. And then eventually they'll don the goggles themselves, because they're operating some kind of contraption or a machine or a vessel or a blimp that is powered by steam. And so the goggles kind of protect their eyes from the steam exhaust. And then that's kind of where the cosplay element comes in. And there's a lot of like corsets and overcoats and lots of goggles and strange rivet type clothing. And so it lends itself very well to steampunk. Tom Waits does good steampunk. Like when he played Renfield in Dracula, in Francis Ford Coppola's version of Dracula. Bram Stoker's Dracula. That element, that setting lends itself to steampunk. There was even talk that like the book The Time Machine, the one that my daughter got me, is the is like the ultimate book of lending itself to the steampunk movement, because it's got this... So I knocked out the first couple chapters, and there's this contraption, and that is basically, the setting is present day 1895, but he's going to the future in this contraption. Back to the Future is very, it's the essence. The movie Back to the Future is almost kind of like the essence of steampunk. Although it, like I say, the genre lends itself to very vivid portrayals, very like strange garb. You know, the garb is really a big part of it. That's why I would think it's a pretty big movement in cosplay. And so I was looking at, like, what, okay, so there's movies that lend, there's books that lend themselves, but there's also, there must be, like, movie-themed steampunk type stuff. And there's obviously different lists, and there's different, they come from different sources and different people and different opinions and so forth. And what but some of the consistent listings, movie listings that they put in these top 10 lists of steampunk movies would be like Metropolis, City of Lost Children, the French movie. There's another one that I actually started watching, oddly enough. I found it on YouTube, and it was based on the H.G. Wells novel, A Look at Things to Come, but it's just called Things to Come, and it's basically this, this movie came out in 1936, right, yeah, because the book came out in 1933, A Look at Things to Come, and then, so they made this movie 3 years later, 1936, and it's obviously black and white, but it basically goes, traces this society that lives in this town, any town, USA, and that it's a very, kind of a picturesque looking town. It's a soundstage, as you could tell, but it lends itself to, anyway, to this kind of a conceptual pre-Hunger Games type thing. And then they go through a Second World War. It's kind of prescient in that regard, because it's 1936. Although, you know, at this time there's kind of, you know, World War II is kind of on the brink in Europe. But here in the States, where they're making the movie, it hasn't. But the movie is showcasing the Second World War that just decimates everything. And then they rebuild it. And then they become a spacefaring interplanetary society. And so all the gizmos and gadgets and the rocket ships and stuff like that are all... That's the steampunk thing. So, but this movie kind of predates a lot of that. It's kind of like the blueprint for the steampunk thing. It's not a straight shot of quote-unquote steampunk, right? That's something you would get, say, like in movies like City of Lost Children, which is a bizarre... That's a wild one. Or Metropolis, or... they even had Wild Wild West, that Will Smith and Kevin Kline movie, which, because I guess it's kind of, I've never seen it, but it's like, he's built these strange little gizmos and gadgets. It's all futuristic, but it's retro. It's back in the day. It's 1800s, but it's futuristic, if that makes sense, right? So, stuff that doesn't exist. Stuff that is designed to propel us to the future, but this takes place in the past, right? Again, retro-futuristic, but in the movie Things to Come, it was interesting, because they, the Second World War decimated this society in this any town USA, and then they all revert back to kind of like this tribalism, and there's a warlord, and the warlord that ran the town after the World War kind of looked like Mark Norman, of all things, the comedian, right? And his wife looked like Jan Hooks from Saturday Night Live back in the 90s, but it was a decent movie. I didn't go all. I didn't watch the very end because, I mean, I don't know what happened. I got sidetracked. I've got a short attention span, people. You got to understand that. But it's just been, for me, a book of weekends. It's a Super Bowl weekend full of felonies, I'm sure. You know, punching TV sets out, punching your domestic partner when your team lost. I'm sorry. Super Bowl statistically is the biggest day of domestic violence. I'm sorry if you have to deal with that, or for that matter, just bad guacamole, bad parties, obnoxious people, people in oversized jerseys for their oversized bellies. Like, if you're a grown man, you got to ditch the jersey. Maybe, okay, on yesterday was fine. You could wear it one day of the year, but for me, this weekend was, it was all about just books and shit. And I had stopped by the library, the Fair Oaks Library, or as they say in French, la bibliothèque. And, they have the bargain book thing, you know, and it's populated with a bunch of old, you know, septuagenarians that are wandering around telling you, you know, pointing you out, like, the hardcover versus, you know, the soft cover paperbacks pricing. And I'm like, I know, lady, get out of my way. Yeah, no, I didn't. But I came across some fucking awesome books. Speaking of Australia, I came across Bruce Chatwin's The Songlines, which I used to own a copy, and it was a really nice paperback, but this was a hardcover. And so I snatched that up for $2. Then I got Cormac McCarthy's last book, Stella Maris, for $2. Hardback. I know. You guys can barely contain yourselves, I'm sure. And then I got a paperback called Geek Love by Catherine Dunn, which is about this carnival, this traveling circus or carnival that these people are running that is on the verge of bankruptcy, but they decide to save themselves from financial collapse by basically, like, ingesting pesticides and medicines and exposing themselves to radiation and having these babies that are just kind of like freaks, and then they populate the circus with them. So, yeah, that's cool. And then I'm like, fuck it. So that was Friday, and then Friday's been my long day, kind of traditionally. So I had to go down to Manteca, Modesto, Merced. So I'm out on the highways, and I finally finished Fight Club, the audio, and didn't disappoint. And then I tried to listen to the rest of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but I'm like, what else you got, right? So, which I'd read a long time ago. I guess it's sci-fi. It is kind of sci-fi. Douglas Adams was, I guess you'd call it sci-fi. But I don't know, sometimes you lose that window of excitement, right? And so I'd moved on. And so Saturday, as the Scottish say, Saturday, if it's not Scottish, it's crap. And Saturday, I was heading up to Grass Valley. And, but prior to taking off, I was listening to, I was on the treadmill. I'm thinking to myself, like, man, I rounded up some good books. Like, I don't know. I get excited for books, whether I read them or not. I don't know. I get excited. And I thought to myself, what's, you know, books are cool. Books are, they have their moment. Typically, they kind of, some of them kind of, you really got to force yourself through them. But in the end, you really enjoy it. You know, you're like, I'm glad I partook in that. But I thought to myself, what's the best, I started thinking to myself, what's the best book I've read ever? which is all, you know, it's subjective. Because there are great, I mean, you know, I mean, if you've been able to kind of make your way through a Dostoevsky, like Crime and Punishment, or, you know, The Idiot, or one of those, I mean, that's, or even Tolstoy, man, War and Peace, I mean, those are the classics, those are the, seemingly the standard bearers, but there's just so many books, I mean, it's really hard to compare, right? But I thought, what's the best book I've ever read? I had to say, you know, I mean, I enjoyed, there's immediately, like, stuff like Libra from Don DeLillo comes to mind, great book about the Kennedy assassination, or more so about Lee Harvey Oswald, his take on the assassination from back in, I think he wrote in the 80s, I think he wrote that book. And there's, you know, Martin Amis, London Fields, Money, just some of the best writing. I mean, that guy was a fucking, you know, that guy's a beast, right? And then you go, but then you go to like Cormac McCarthy, you go, man, like people that can write like that, like you just, that are, it's so hard to digest, but it's, you it's like it's, that you're going through something, like you don't quite understand it at the time, but it's dense, it's hard, it's like, that's what you take away from those books. But the best book I've ever read, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That's easy. Just fucking maniacal. And I thought to myself, well, why don't I, because I've read it, I've read that one a couple times. It's a fucking, it's so, every page, like, I even started, I watched a review, a book review on YouTube. This guy said there's not an unexciting part in the entire book. Like, every page just leaps off. It's just fucking, it's so good. It's so good. So I'm like, fucking, I'll load that shit on the phone on my way up to Grass Valley. I'll listen to that. It obviously didn't disappoint. I mean, it's so over the top, but that's Hunter S. Thompson. He's a journalist. This is a journalist that decided, like, in 71, the year of our Dark Lord, 1971, the year I was born, the year that Elon Musk was born, the year that this book came out. Who else was born in 71? Seems like somebody else was born in 71. That was really cool. But, it's so fuck. I mean, we were somewhere outside of Barstow when the drugs began to take hold. I mean, it's best first line, one of the best first lines in any novel ever, right? But it's this guy. It's about this guy. You get so caught up in just the antics of this guy that you forget that the book itself had this high arcing kind of, you know, post-60s kind of malaise. It's just like, you know, when you look out across the desert there, and you can almost see the high water mark on in chapter 8, you know, when he finishes by saying, you know, you can see where the wave broke and then retreated, you know, when we almost figured it out, you know, the 60s almost figured it out, but it came back to haunt, you know, it came crashing back on him, the American dream. He went out to look for the American dream. And the American, Hunter S. Thompson had this fixation with the American dream, right? Which, I mean, it's so funny because, you know, we're always like, it's such a wild subject, the American dream, but because nobody else, there aren't Europeans like looking for the European dream. There aren't Africans looking for the African dream, but the Americans are always looking, they're always navel gazing. Like, you know, what is it? What is the essence of the American dream? Well, this book is the essence of the American dream, and it's so deranged and it's so fucking funny and it's so good. You know, anybody with $1.98 can go project themselves 12 times the size of God and just say whatever pops into their mind. It's just one of the best lines ever, you know? It's just so bizarre, but it struck home because it's being Super Bowl weekend. I mean, that was the essence of this guy. Like, I thought, you know, there's nothing more pivotal very few things that are more pivotal in the pursuit of the American dream than LSD, right? I mean, LSD is like what the CIA created for the MK Ultra experiment, you know, where they were dosing people to use kind of in an experiment to learn how to do mind control, right? The CIA was doing this. CIA was trying to control the hippie population by opening these places where unsuspecting guys would go in for, like, thinking they were going to get a massage or be with a prostitute and get dosed with LSD. This is real. This has all been documented in the book Chaos. The kind of the end of the 60s with Charles Manson and, you know, the Sharon Tate killings and all that in 69. It all got away from him, right? And it was all based on this experiment that was run by the CIA, the MK Ultra, which had started in Palo Alto, where Ken Kesey was one of the subjects being experimented on, one of the Stanford University students that was being experimented on with this acid, who then crossed paths with people like the Grateful Dead, Hunter S. Thompson, and all these people in the 60s who were just kind of, you know, finding their stride. But Hunter S. Thompson then took it from there and then kind of became an acid head himself. But Hunter S. Thompson was just one of these characters that just, like, sometimes he would take so much, he would overdo it enough to where, like when Ali fought Foreman in Zaire in Africa, he went out to go cover it, and he didn't even make it to the fight. He was so convinced that Foreman was going to beat Ali, he couldn't watch it. So I think he just smoked a joint and then floated in the hotel pool and then just wrote an article based on that. And the same with, like, the Super Bowl. I mean, this is a guy that just, he would be sent to Miami to go cover the Super Bowl, and then he would never make it to the game, you know? So in kind of a weird, strange tribute to him, I don't know if I'm going to, I'll probably watch the game today. Maybe, probably, I'm sure I'll watch it, but it's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of a distraction more than anything to, like I say, to the other kind of craziness that's going on, the halftime show, the build-up to the halftime show, the opening act, the person singing the national anthem, the commercials, the Visa commercials, the fucking Tom Brady commercials, the Jerry Seinfeld commercials, the fucking, you name it, fucking, it's like the game itself is just a distraction. And all you gotta, honestly, I think your only objective is really just to not punch your TV set out, not to fight or go at it with anybody, and just try and contain yourself, you motherfucker. And, you know, and just be the fucking depraved American that you know you are, right? Regardless of what happened. It's going to be savage. It's going to be, like, when I get done recording this, I'm heading out and there's going to be nobody on the streets. There's going to be nobody. This is a public holiday. This is like, you know, the NFL's taken over. All we care about now is Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce and Pfizer and, you know, Usher and the halftime show and, you know, Nipplegate and Janet Jackson and what a crap show Rihanna was last year when she was pregnant. And isn't there a game in there somewhere? I don't know. That to me is the American dream. Is like the objective that we're solely here to see is really just primarily a distraction, you know, like the election. Like, we've already decided our candidates. The candidates are already, like, there's going to be no debate. It's February and we already know the two candidates. This is fucking insane. This is postmodern. It's everything that's wrong with society, right? But like I said, yeah, LSD could have changed things for the better. Could have been, could have expanded our horizons and opened our minds and, but we went the other way with it. Yeah. And that's the essence of what it is to be an American, right? So I hope you could take a little something away from this. I know I did. I feel like we've grown from this. I feel like we've shared an experience. I feel like we've broken bread. I feel like we're all a different person now after this podcast. And all I can say is go Niners. But it's now 2:01 p.m. Sunday Pacific time. We've got an hour and 29 minutes till kickoff, and I'm saying Chiefs 42, San Francisco 13, and I'll leave it at that. Oh yeah, my son lost his job. But not anything that he did. But then he walked right over from Central Valley VW, and he went over to Central Valley Dodge and applied to be a salesman. So I'll keep you posted. And on that note, I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies.